8:30, and we are joined in the studios once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hello.
Oh, are we talking now?
Yes, we are on the air
we
now.
We are. That would be the...
Wake up, Jav.
I am here. Yes, I am. Really, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you both?
Good.
Good. The drugs are kicking in. I'm fine.
Yeah. That would be your can of Coke or Pepsi.
I try and you know, alternate. I don't want to give too much support to either company, so I support both instead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas I've kicked the caffeine habit happily. But that means I'm not quite as sharp as I should be in the mornings.
All right. So, I was gone this last week, and unfortunately we had a tragedy to local activism.
Yeah, Tyree Scott passed away. There was actually a little photo of him in the Seattle Times obit that looked like it was taken about 35 years ago. I don't think they've been tracking his career too closely. I knew Tyree. I think most activists in town have known him or encountered him at one time or another. He's really just a remarkable gentleman. He'd been battling prostate cancer for some time, and in his early 60s. I think he was 63 when he passed away on Thursday. But the amazing thing is that, you know, as a civil rights leader in the 60s, and there's a cluster of 60s civil rights activists and radicals who are still in town and still doing good things. But I mean, what had always amazed me about Tyree, made me respectful of him, is that he has been walking the talk for a really long time. He was involved in labor issues. He was involved in starting LILO when they were battling the Marcos dictatorship and had the assassinations in the early 80s. He's been still involved in civil rights. He's been involved in support for Mozambique and other African countries and raising material aid there. Just a really, really fine gentleman and a loss for the community. And so it's, you know, we're gonna start losing folks from that generation, and need to preserve that history and you know, pay our props to our elders.
Yeah, we've had his talks on here on Mind Over Matters many times, and just an amazing speaker. I mean,
yeah,
he
very eloquent.
In such a good perspective of history, of our history into things, and it's a major loss for the local community.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So let's...
And on that feel-good note...
Yeah. Let's move along. The U-District is unshackling itself from...
unshackling itself from the burden of having to actually, you know, like provide housing for students or small businesses that might serve students or any of those icky things. Mayor Nichols really pushed very hard for something that the University of Washington and major landlords and developers in the University District had wanted for a number of years. And City Council, by a 6-3 vote, including Judy Nicastro, interestingly enough, went along with the idea of the abolishing the lease lid program for the university district, which literally was a lid on the amount of leasing of land that the University of Washington can do. As folks who are familiar with their campus and that part of the city are probably aware, the lower part of the campus, the sciences area, which is almost entirely at this point funded and brings in money from corporate and military research grants. There's been a lot of pressure from the university to try and expand that part of the campus out into the university area. You can see the results of that in the area below about 42nd and around Roosevelt. If you go to the other side of Roosevelt, much of the housing there that students traditionally have been able to use has been lost over the last 10 years. And the rest of the U District's going to look like that in a very short period of time as well. And it's a sort of thing where it sends UW well on the way to being a commuter school, because, you know, students from outside the area who come into the city won't be able to find housing on their own. So unless you can commute from where mom and dad lives, or you can find a cheap house to share in Kent, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to go to UW unless you're independently wealthy and can afford market rate rent in the city. Beyond that, it's been a very, very telling and interesting set of developments in terms of Mayor Nickel's vision for the city of Washington. You've had three different neighborhood conflicts now that pit really neighborhood activists against the major landholders in the area. There's Paul Allen and Vulcan in South Lake Union. Versus Cascade Neighborhood and some of the other neighborhood groups there. There's the company that owns Northgate Mall trying to expand that area.
Simon Property Group.
Versus the neighborhood group there. And there was UW and the various landholders in the university district. And in all three cases, Nichols has been pushing very hard on behalf of big money. And against the interests of people who actually live in the city and actually try and make the city work. So it's very telling that this has been the priority of this mayoralship and that he very much plays hardball on these kind of issues. And it's, you know, kind of reminiscent of 10 years ago when you started to have this schism between the mayor's office and city council and neighborhood groups, and that was what gave rise to the whole movement with Charlie Chong and a lot of those folks was that kind of alienation. And, you know, maybe it's time we got another election coming up and we got to send those guys a message that, you know, we need some challenges for city council and some of these other races that that can remind people that you know, we live in this city too.
And who on city council has been backing up the mayor on some of this stuff? I know Jim Compton was last minute in the South Lake Union neighborhood to try and foreclose any discussion by the neighborhood on how to amend what was going on.
Yeah, Jen Drago had a fascinating quote regarding the lease lid about this will help make the university competitive. Well, who is a state land grant university supposed to be competing with? I mean, that's kind of a, you know, I wasn't aware that we're supposed to acknowledge that it in fact is a large corporation that, you know, services students as an afterthought. But Margaret Pagler was particularly vehement on this issue also.
Those are the usual suspects. But what was Judy Nicastro thinking?
Well, that's a good question. And what was Peter Steinbrück thinking also? He was also a yes vote. They had offered an amendment to try and basically it was a housing amendment that would have ameliorated the loss of affordable housing. That amendment didn't pass, but then they went and voted for the overall whole package, the abolition. So it's a good question what they were asking. What was, you know, Heidi Wills thinking on this issue?
I think the university played hardball, and it's kind of interesting that they would do that now when the university district and in fact business areas throughout the city are suffering a downturn because of the economy. But the interesting thing, too, is that Judy Nicastro, who's pretty good at holding the line on some stuff, really kind of caved in on this.
Yeah, and there's...
I disagree. I think she was heading this way from the start because I remember back when she was catching all that flack for sending off letters and responding to people a little too flippantly, you know, and this stranger was regularly coming to her. And she had said at that time that she was going to just mind one issue from there on out, and that was the UAW's master plan. And that when I heard that was the first time I'd actually heard of the UAW's master plan, and that kind of worried me.
Made that her issue,
right?
Try and shepherd this thing through to an agreement.
And you know, Judy has not been particularly internally consistent with where she falls on different issues. That's been one of the things that has frustrated people about her during her first term. And of course, she's up for re-election this year.
Yeah.
Too.
So should we add her to the list of the usual suspects?
Well. No, because she's not predictable, and that's the problem. She's not predictable going either way. But you know, and beyond that, we have the whole phenomenon again of the Nichols administration. That this was particularly the point in time at which they chose to make this push. And there's also, you know, the U District Chamber of Commerce was a big player in this also, and they very much are representing the U District and big players as opposed to the small businesses who are also going to get really hurt by this. And there was a whole flap around the U District Street Fair this year also where the Chamber of Commerce really really put those businesses at a disadvantage. So
okay. Well, let's move along. Speaking of campaigns, Bush had a
speaking of big money.
Big money. Yeah, Bush had a campaign kickoff this week.
Yeah, he kicked off his campaign, I believe it was Tuesday night, with a big $2,000 a plate dinner attended by about 1,400 people in a ritzy ballroom in Washington, D.C. There was a nice article on it the next day in the Washington Post, the official organ of record for glitzy Washington ballrooms. And it was very interesting who was there. Of course, it was, you know, sort of the usual array of CEOs and lobbyists and Republican Party bigwigs. The Republican Party itself on the same day got a new boss. Bush named Ed Gillespie, a very high-powered corporate lobbyist who has been in and out of the Bush administration and was on his transition team and so forth, to be the RNC's head for the next 17 months through the 2004 election. His entire job will be to raise money for the Republican Party, for President Bush. And the Bush campaign wants $200 million, which is double what it got when it broke all of those records for campaign fundraising in 2000. And the interesting thing about, and incidentally, he had the one dinner this week, but he's also planning another 10 of those in the next 5 weeks in different cities, just to go in different cities and start collecting the cash very, very early. For a presidential campaign to be kicking off in this fashion. And they just, you know, they need all that extra time to raise all the money they want and intend to raise. The other interesting thing about this is that, you know, Bush, as far as anybody knows or expects, will face no primary opposition from other Republicans. He will get the Republican nomination for president in August of 2004 at their convention. And he has said that he intends to accept federal matching funds for the general election in November 2004. So by law, the money that he raises now, the money that he raises before the convention, has to be spent before he becomes the Republican nominee for president. And since he faces no opposition, the question is, well, why raise all of that money? Well, some of it's going to be raised just to position himself against the Democrats, obviously, but much more of it has nothing to do with his need for money at all. It's bribery, pure and simple. It's saying, I've done all of this for you. I'm going to do even more for the next 4 years, from 2004 to 2008. Place your orders now. And for, you know, for any large corporation that gets, as for example, with either of the big tax cut bills, you know, billions of dollars down the line in additional profits or additional cash, and you know, individuals are making out like bandits, from wealthy individuals from a number of Bush's actions as well. You know, putting $1 million into Bush's reelection campaign is a sound business investment. So, you know, with remarkable return should he win. So this is the kind of money that the Democrats are up against. This is why the Democrats feel a good deal of pressure to unite behind a single candidate relatively early in the process. And where this all leads is that money determines who we have on the ballot that we can choose from, because by the time the primaries roll around in 2004, there's a very good chance that these decisions will all be made. And similar to 2000, you know, the nominees will be essentially be sewn up, and it'll be all but show. So it really is a very pernicious sort of development. And, you know, we're seeing all this happen even after that much vaunted campaign finance reform bill was supposed to take big money out of the electoral process. So it was sort of a grim reminder that this is still really what it's all about at that level.
All right. Well, speaking of...
And corruption, I might... Mm. did we hear the word corruption?
Speaking of people who have the title of president but weren't necessarily elected, I understand...
and who really like their militaries, yeah.
Yes, Musharraf is coming to the White House.
General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan.
Yes, a meeting of two minds. He will be in Washington on Tuesday to meet with President Bush, two unelected presidents, getting together to talk about old times in the front lines. That was a joke. And, you know, it will be very interesting to see how that visit is covered, because U.S. media tend to give Musharraf way more respect than he deserves. And the same is true for Bush, of course. But there was a preview article on this that I believe is in this morning's New York Times that talks about Pakistani, you know, support for North Korean nuclear weapons program, and how Bush is going to say that he thanks Musharraf for cracking down on al-Qaeda, but in private he wants him to do even more, et cetera, et cetera. A number of things that are not mentioned. One, of course, is that Pakistan is a dictatorship, that Musharraf has been moving closer and closer in many ways to President Bush since 9/11, and this is actually a source of resentment throughout not just Pakistan, but a good chunk of the Muslim world, because the guy is a thug. He is a dictator that has the sort of sensibilities that Saddam Hussein did, but instead of invading Pakistan, we are shoveling enormous amounts of weapons toward them. Musharraf has also done way more to support terrorism than Saddam Hussein ever did, and that includes the sort of activity in Kashmir that led to that ugly nuclear confrontation a year ago. And of course, you know, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. We know they do.
They've tested them. We don't know that about North Korea and Iran.
Yeah, and they are expanding that stockpile, even still.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are should be leading the United States to condemn Pakistan, and instead, we're giving them more weapons and more money, and encouraging them to go out there and have all the elections you want. Just make sure that they're as much of a farce as the ones last year were.
Yeah, and in fact, the elections last year for President Pervez Musharraf won them. They were rigged, and most of the Pakistani population knows that they were rigged, and that has actually driven people to support radical Muslim fundamentalist parties in Pakistan who are in opposition to Musharraf. So the fact that we actually support him there in Pakistan, and that he's a dictator, and that we don't acknowledge that, actually means that we're fanning the flames of Muslim fundamentalism in Pakistan.
A dictator who came to power originally through a military coup. I mean, he gave himself the title president because general didn't sound as good. The United States has gone and demanded the removal of people who rigged elections in the past. That's what we did with Milosevic. That, you know, you can look at a long line, but in the case of Pakistan, we just winked and patted him on the back and said, "You go, guy." So they'll be in town.
All right. Well, moving along, Iraq continues to grab headlines, but not always the important stories.
Yeah, a lot of the stories in Iraq never get mentioned. So, of course, again, this week I have a list of what happened this week in Iraq for folks. On the top of my list is that the new Iraq survey group that will be replacing the 7 idled site survey teams in Iraq who are supposed to be searching for weapons of mass destruction. We talked last week about those 7 site survey teams sitting on their hands and not doing anything because they've looked everywhere they could look and they haven't found anything. Well, there's a new Iraq survey group that's going to be about 1,400 people who are on their way over there. But they have a multitude of tasks that they're supposed to accomplish. And I just want to remind people that they're not just supposed to be looking for weapons of mass destruction. At the top of their list is finding Saddam Hussein. And then they're also supposed to be collecting evidence for war crimes trials against former Ba'ath Party members. They're also supposed to be screening government officials, scientists, and other professionals in order to weed out the hardcore Ba'ath Party sympathizers and or past human rights abusers. They're going to be interviewing scientists, former government officials, lab technicians, laborers, and ordinary Iraqi citizens about weapons of mass destruction, sifting through millions of documents looking for little tiny clues about weapons of mass destruction. And then kind of at the bottom of their list is actually going to various sites and looking for the actual weapons of mass destruction. So these 1,400 people are going to be very, very busy. And the top thing on their list is not necessarily finding weapons of mass destruction. It's at this point, it's finding Saddam Hussein so that the attacks against U.S. soldiers will halt. That is, if you actually believe that Saddam Hussein is responsible for them, which is not at all clear.
And just about about everything on that list is things that I would have thought the United States would have been doing from the get-go two and a half months ago.
That the military
would be able to do. Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Evidently not, and these new personnel on the Iraq survey team are actually many of them former UN weapons inspectors, and they'll be using a lot of the same techniques that UN weapons inspectors had used before, and those techniques were widely criticized by the Bush administration, but lo and behold, we're now using them. Also, the LA Times reported this week that the new Iraq survey team won't actually be functioning fully for several weeks. So much for the big rush to find weapons of mass destruction.
And for that matter, the evidence of human rights abuses. I mean, that should really be at the top of the list.
Yeah, much of that evidence is going to go missing because...
Well, it's actually gone missing already.
Yeah, because you have relatives of people who were killed by the Saddam Hussein administration who are going out and digging up mass graves and destroying a lot of the evidence that would allow... that would allow this Iraq survey team to collect data on mass killings, for example. A lot of that information will be gone by the time the Iraq survey team actually gets operating in the next several weeks, and who knows how long several weeks will be. I know that I read reports saying that the Iraq survey team should have already been over there working by now, and they're not. So there's been a lot of delays on that end. Now, the Times of London also reported this week that British Major General Freddie Vigors, now he's the guy who serves as the British commander in the U.S. headquarters at Baghdad. He's been working with the U.S. military there. He's kind of the lead British military guy there. He told the Times of London that British troops may have to stay in Iraq as long as 4 years. And here's a direct quote from him. He said, "This is the single most chaotic organization I have ever worked for. The operation is chronically under-resourced and suffers an almost complete absence of strategic direction." That's the lead British commander in the U.S. headquarters in Baghdad, talking about the U.S. occupation authority.
Can we start using the Q word anytime soon?
Now, another thing happened in Britain this week, too. You had two cabinet ministers who resigned in the Blair government over the Iraq war, over the buildup to the Iraq war, because they thought it was unethical and that there was not enough time being given to the UN weapons inspectors to do their job, and they thought that the intelligence didn't support going to war. Those two cabinet ministers are testifying at hearings in Parliament now over whether the Blair government exaggerated or actually outright lied about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, Robin Cook and Claire Short. They both testified that they had been part of briefings with MI6, that's the Secret Intelligence Service, briefings that MI6 had given to the British government, to the British cabinet ministers, about the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they both said that the evidence did not support going to war, and that MI6 had told them that Saddam's weapons of mass destruction did not pose a threat internationally. Claire Short also said that a date had been fixed well ahead of time for the war to start, and back on about September 24th, one of the senior members of the Blair government told her that regardless of what the UN weapons inspectors did, the date had already been fixed for the war. That's major news that never made it overseas here. Meanwhile, USA Today reported that Paul Wolfowitz, that's Deputy Defense Secretary, that's the number two guy to Donald Rumsfeld, he told a House Armed Service Committee that U.S. troops could be in Iraq for 10 years or more.
Oh, by the way, can I put one another thing on the September fixing date? That was before Congress gave authority to Bush to launch the war. That happened in October.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd point that out.
That was way back. So they had this in mind for a long, long time. But Paul Wolfowitz told the House Armed Services Committee this week that U.S. troops could be in Iraq for 10 years or more. 10 years or more, that's more than a decade, at a cost of $3 billion per month. That's the cost estimate that he gave them, and that there were no plans to reduce the number of troops in Iraq in the foreseeable future.
That's a third of a trillion of dollars over 10 years mm-hmm. for people who want to do that math quickly.
Now, this is at the same time
and
where...
That's just the monetary costs. Obviously, right. That's not right. troops yeah. and civilians being yeah. killed.
Right. Now, this is at the same time that the New York Times, the mainstream press here in the U.S. and in Britain, ran articles on the psychological impact of the war on U.S. troops for the first time. Now, the alternative press here has been talking about this since the war began, and I know that I wrote an article about it back in March. But the New York Times ran what's now becoming a well-talked-about article in Washington, D.C., entitled, quote, "Anxious and Weary of War, GIs Face a New Iraq Mission." Now, in that article is the quote that everybody I've been talking to has been quoting, and it's Private First Class Matthew O'Dell of the 1st Brigade of the Army's 3rd Division told the New York Times reporter, quote, "You call Donald Rumsfeld and tell him our sorry asses are ready to go home. Tell him to come spend a night in our building." So, now that's at the same time you have Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld's deputy, telling the House Armed Services Committee that the troops are going to be there for 10 years or
yeah,
more.
Yeah, Rumsfeld won't spend a night in their building. He hires people to do that.
That's right. So that's some of the stuff that's been going on. I think I have some more here on my list. I just have to find it. Yes, there is one more thing I want to talk about on my list. That the New York Times also reported this week that U.S. troops were on the verge of conducting the first real election in Iraq in the city of Najaf. Now, some elections have gone on, but they've been a council of people that the U.S. had assembled among who they thought the senior people were in various cities, and then those people would vote on somebody among their ranks to be mayor, sort of a little selected election. But this was going to be a full general election of all the residents of the city of Najaf. Now, U.S. troops had built ballot boxes, they'd registered voters, they'd even helped and seen political parties print up flyers that they then distributed around, so there was a nice healthy campaigning going on. There were several different parties and candidates for mayor. And then Paul Bremer hit Baghdad.
The new
U.S. viceroy.
And it's never very easy when they change viceroys. There's always new policies.
There's always some new
in.
Policies
yeah.
that come in. And he called a complete halt to the proceedings in Najaf, and he barred all general elections in Iraq. Now, why he would do this when the troops on the ground, in their opinions, thought that Najaf was secure, it was a safe city, there, you know, people were fairly happy, there was a decent food supply, water supply, some electricity, and that they were ready for it. He called a halt, it seems, because the candidate who was most likely to win as mayor is a member of the Supreme Council for the Revolution in Iraq, which has ties to the Iranian government and Iranian Shiite groups, and he was afraid that this guy would be a Muslim fundamentalist fanatic who would be urging the residents of Najaf to fight against the U.S. military occupation. However, the actual candidate himself is a professional man who, although he is a member of SCIRI, the Supreme Council for the Revolution in Iraq, is a very reasonable guy and has stated that he had no intention of forming a shura or ruling religiously in Najaf.
But even if he did, I mean, think of the message that sends. Well, you know, after we couldn't find the weapons of mass destruction, the next of the many justifications for this war was that we were going to bring democracy to Iraq. Well, so much for that. We'll bring democracy to Iraq unless we don't like the person who may get elected, in which case we'll go right back to doing what Saddam Hussein did, which was, you know, squash all possibility of democratic reforms and appoint our own people.
Yeah, and this comes on top of Paul Bremer saying that issuing edicts almost every other day about what the press in Iraq can and cannot print, which is direct censorship. And Iraqi journalists have said that to the U.S. press, that we've seen exactly the same edicts from Saddam Hussein What the heck is going on?
And you've also had incidents where the U.S. military has gone in and literally destroyed the offices of the Shiite, what were perceived as fundamentalist Shiite political parties. So there has been active political repression going on, not just cancellation of elections.
Right. And there's also been some repression of these issues here in the U.S. The U.S. media has not covered any of these things, which is why I'm mentioning them here on the radio and hoping that people will get this information out and talk about it with their friends. And at the same time, the U.S. Congress is suppressing, particularly among the Republicans, but also among some wimpy Democrats, suppressing an investigation that should be happening into what the Bush administration actually knew about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction versus what they told the Americans. People. There are closed sessions going on in both the Senate and the House. Those should be open sessions, and it should be the full Congress paying attention to this issue, not just a few members who can then cover it up and bury the issue.
Yeah, and you contrast that with what you're mentioning earlier about the ministers testifying in Britain. They're testifying before full hearings of Parliament that are open to the public.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. We're talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell our listeners where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around town and on the east side. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to rant and rave at us, you can give us a call at our voice message number, 206-903-9461.